House Committee on Agriculture and Forestry, Tuesday, April 20th, hearing room D.
We're going to start out with House Bill 2425. This is a bill we worked on a month or so ago. I believe the judge is here this morning. Come on up. This was a bill introduced by Representative Thompson at the request of Judge Thomas Branford from over in the, you're at Newport?
Yes.
Newport, dealing with dogs and nuisance dogs and this sort of thing, not dogs and livestock, but dogs and people more than anything else, as I would understand it. I understand you've been working on some amendments. You and the Humane Society worked on these?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Go ahead and state your name again for our tape.
I'm Tom Branford, here in support of House Bill 2425. Chuck Taylor sent me on March 31st a fax of what the bill would look like as amended. I don't know if you have that or not.
Mm-hmm. We do, I believe.
The document we just passed out, this is what the statutes would look like with the amendments.
Maybe you can run us through it a little bit and talk about some of the issues that we brought up when we first...
Can I ask Harrison a question?
Yeah, Representative Barr.
I don't see any bold-faced language in this hand-written letter. Version, is there anything in there? Do we have to kind of wade through ourselves to figure out what's new and what's old?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, I would be happy to walk you through that. I'm sorry I did not have an opportunity to hand engross this myself that night. But I can walk you through where I believe the new language is.
Yeah, that's up to the chair if you want to take time. Otherwise, I'll figure it out in my own letter.
Why don't you then, Judge, we'll let Harrison kind of go through this a little bit then, so we can get up to speed of what we have here in front of us.
In the first section, 609.010, and I would certainly appreciate the judge's backup if he sees that I'm missing anything, subsection 2, we have changed the language to occupied by, that in running at large means a dog is off or outside of the premises, occupied by rather than owned by the keeper. Lower in subsection 2A, or subsection 2C, we have added a condition. Running at large does not include a dog that's securely in a vehicle, that's confined securely in a vehicle that prevents the dog from biting a person. Moving to page 2, 609.090, subsection 4, at least a portion of that language is new. The last lines indicate that reasonable restrictions may include but are not limited to sterilization and the implementation of an identification microchip. I believe, in fact, that whole section is new, but it indicates that the keeper is responsible for paying the fees, the cost of reasonable restrictions. All of subsection 5 is new at the top of the next page.
What page are we on now?
We're on page 3.
Okay. Where was the fee part?
I'm sorry, actually, all of subsection 4 is new. The top portion indicates that the keeper must agree to pay the cost of reasonable restrictions applied by the judge.
This is under section 3, the $10 and the $20.
The entire section, subsection 4.
Oh, all subsection 4. I see, okay.
We're on page 3 and I'll be more comfortable. Okay, moving on to page 4, you'll see that there is a new ORS section there, 609.AAA.
What was on page 3? Nothing?
Nothing that was
subsection 5. Subsection 5 at the top of page 3 is new. This is a section which we discovered as we were looking at the bill that the keeper of the dog was not necessarily bound by the court to meet the reasonable restrictions. So this section now says that the keeper of the dog, keeper of a dog must provide proof that he's maintaining the reasonable restrictions, or he is in fact keeping a dog that's a nuisance.
Are you just going through right now, excuse me, telling us what it's about? We don't ask questions at this point.
Yeah, we can ask questions. Actually, we need to, this is a work session on 24, 25.
Well, I have a question in that the section you were just talking about, Harrison, the 609.AA, 1C, boy, I think it's very vague. The impact of keeper actions on the behavior of the dog. I don't know what you're thinking about there, but not you personally, but, you know, the drafter of the bill, because there would be some things that would be obvious, like if the keeper sat back there and said, sick 'em. I mean, you know, that's obvious. We'd all know what that is. But there are a lot of other interactions between an owner, the person having control of the animal, and the animal that may have nothing to do with, but then a bite results, but there's no connection. I think this would be very hard to prove unless it was an overt, clear type of action. And so I guess I would like to know whoever suggested that, what they were thinking about.
Maybe the judge can, this is Representative Uberall, this is okay. Judge Branford, who worked on this bill along with the Humane Society. You can just step right in this any time.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Uberall, the criteria set forth in Section AAA were recommended by the Humane Society as factors that a court should consider in determining whether or not to have a dog euthanized. And so I can't say what prompted the Humane Society to come up with these factors, but in redrafting this since our last meeting, this was what they sent to me, and I simply drafted this in accord with their letter.
Well, let me ask you the question then, Judge. If you were hearing this case, would that be a bright line to you? You know, how would you, as a trier of fact, look at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uberall, let me ask you to take a look at Section 2 down below.
Okay.
That whether it's the county dog board or the court making a decision about whether or not to euthanize a dog, none of the factors above are controlling. So that was simply an additional factor for the court to consider. This is after conviction and in deciding what action to take in response to a bite situation. So it clearly is not... it's not intended as the one standard that needs to be met or proven. It's just a factor, one among many, that the Humane Society recommended. And I know there was some concern expressed at the last meeting. The thought of killing a dog is an unpalatable concept for a lot of people, and understandably so. And you can speak certainly to the Humane Society, but my sense is that it's, to the extent that maybe a keeper is a particularly vulgar sort, that if under different circumstances, you know, one of the options obviously is having the dog moved to a different owner of the keeper, and whether that would afford significant protection for the public in the future if there were simply a different person in control of the dog. But I invite your comment.
Mr. Chair, Teresa Miller with the Oregon Humane Society, he's exactly correct. We basically just wanted there to be other options other than the destruction of the dog, if that was possible. And that's where that language came from.
Representative Byron.
Mr. Chair, I guess doesn't subsection 2 of that new section pretty much just negate everything above it?
Mm-hmm.
When it says that the dog control, the governing board, or the court basically doesn't have to take any of these factors in consideration. I mean, they can, but he doesn't have to.
I'm happy to respond. Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, that's true, but in suggesting that there are a number of things for a court to consider, what's important is that I don't think you would intend, and I think it would really be unwieldy to say that the state would have to prove A through I before a dog could be destroyed. I mean, that would be a ridiculous burden. Essentially, you would nullify that as an option in a case where it might be appropriate. And so that Section 2 was intended to say the state doesn't have to prove all of those factors in order for that to be an appropriate, you know, in order for a court to legally authorize euthanizing a dog. And so that was the purpose for including Section 2. So you certainly can't, I mean, there's a mandate here that the court consider this or the county board consider it. And all subsection 2 says is doesn't nullify A through I. It simply says all of those factors don't have to exist before a court or a county board could do that.
President Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Judge, in the very last sentence there, would it clarify it any if it said and is not required to treat any one factor listed in that subsection as controlling?
That'd be fine.
I'm just wondering if it would clarify it any, or if it makes it, or if it would make it muddier. I mean, from a judge's perspective, or does it make any difference? Because to say to treat any factor means that they, to me, it would mean that they don't have to consider any of those factors at all. But to say any one factor then means that you know, there's not any, these are the factors that they should consider because it says so up above, but that one is not more important than the other. In other words, they're not listed in priority.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I certainly think that would be an appropriate amendment to add the word one.
Okay. Okay, Harrison, why don't you... Okay. Through this.
Moving to page 5, we have a new section, 609.BBB. This section provides for judicial review of the first decision to kill a dog or impose other restrictions. Moving to the very bottom of that page, subsection 3 of 609.095 is new. The first portion of that list those circumstances which make a dog a public nuisance.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Thank you. I have a question about 1D and 1E in particular, and let me explain both, and then maybe I can have a response from the judge.
Which are, by the way, existing language.
In existing law or in the bill that was...
That's current law.
You're kidding. The reason I say that, for example, it says trespasses on private property. Trespass in assumes some knowledge, some intent. A dog doesn't.
We have a copy of the Dag 1. I know. I believe that way.
Well, I know.
Does everyone have a copy of the Dag 1?
We can enact laws in the past that were pretty stupid, too, so I don't. I'm sorry. But trespasses means that you know you're on somebody's property that you don't recognize as your own. I mean, dogs are very intelligent, but I don't know with.
Representative Ubala, we know you read all this. We're not going to allow you to read old language. Criticize that.
Well, we shouldn't have lost and scattered garbage.
You don't get an opportunity to.
Well, Mr. Chair, we'll allow.
We can change it.
The effect of the, at this point, I'm not sure it's the effect of the bill or the effect of the amendments or the combination of the two would eliminate the authority of a court or of a decision maker to kill the dog for those factors. Under the bill and amendment, a dog could only be killed for biting a person or for menacing or chasing, which I think we're seeing as a precursor to biting.
Where are we? We're still on page 5?
On page 5, subsection 3 is new. I mentioned this is the section which requires that if a keeper fails to comply with the restrictions or provide proof the keeper is, in fact, keeping a dog that's a public nuisance by failing to comply with reasonable restrictions. Moving to the bottom of page 6, well, I guess, yeah, the bottom of page 6, 609.100, I just wanted to mention here that about the sixth line from the bottom, $25 is the new fee agreed upon in the amendment, with a lesser fee for a dog that is spayed or neutered, $3. On the last page, page 8.
What about page 7? Nothing?
I don't believe so. I don't believe there's on page 8, beginning about line 8, actually it begins at the end of line 6. This section, however, if the dog has menaced or chased a person when not on the premises, we realize that in the original bill we had essentially removed the authority of the court to kill a dog under any circumstances but a dog bite. So this language has been added back in to say that if, in fact, the dog is menacing or chasing a person when not on the premises of the keeper, the decision maker can go down to subsection 3, which includes a larger fine that accompanies a bite and the potential to kill the dog, having considered those circumstances in the I believe that was subsection, that was section 2. In subsection 3, the middle of this page, 3A, we have new language from the amendment that indicates that if the dog is not killed after having bitten or menaced or chased a person, the dog shall be sterilized and have a microchip implanted, both procedures at the expense of the keeper. I think that fundamentally represents the new language from the amendment.
Well, that's quite an amendment, then. This is all part of Dash 1, then. So we have,
yes, which you do have from your member packets, and I'm sure we have some extras if we need them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
There are, Harrison, isn't there other sections in parts you didn't describe that is new language, and it may not be totally new language, but I just kind of following along the bill, and there is, other sections of those sections that are new things here and there.
I hope that I have not missed anything substantial, but that is possible.
Did you mention the part about the implantation of a microchip?
Yes, you did.
Okay. I was busy highlighting that.
So, Judge, Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair, why would you order the dog to be undergo sterilization and the implantation of an identification microchip?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, the basic reason for that is if a dog's running at large and a nuisance and all these other things, we feel like we don't want that dog to have any more babies, and we want to be able to keep track of that dog. And by microchipping, we can keep track of the dog so that if it doesn't have a collar and all those other things, we still know that this was the dog that did this or did that.
Paul?
Yes, Representative Hill.
Who is me?
The vet.
Judge, how do you feel about this whole thing? You're the one that has brought the issue here to the legislature in your court. You have had experience dealing with these types of issues. Have we made improvement in the statutes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm thrilled with this. I'm delighted with the input from the Humane Society, the other comments that have been made here in the last meeting. I just had another case last week, a dog bite on a kid, $25. It was a bad bite. It's really tough when you're the one sitting there saying, look what I'm doing for you today, and you're talking to the parents of the person. It happened just last week. So I'm delighted with this because I think it represents a significant improvement in terms of options that are available to a court in a bad situation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Deckert.
I have a comment and then a question. First, in terms of 609-095, I was thinking based on Representative Uberlaw's statement on scatters, garbage, or trespasses, perhaps we would do mandatory minimums for dogs there. I know Representative is here, but might be able to include that.
Was this a Measure 11?
Well, or just some sort of mandatory minimum sentencing. My question is, in terms of the chip or the, who would the judge have the discretion to, and what would that achieve in terms of the biting or the malicious?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deckert, basically that would allow us to keep track of the dog, so if the dog bites somebody, we know that it's the same dog that bites again, and we know that for sure by the microchipping. Does that answer the question?
Follow
up? Yes.
In other states, do you know if they have?
Representative Deckert, I apologize, my client's not here, and she would be able to answer that, so I can get that information for you. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
We have a couple of questions on that issue. I mean, are vets going to have scanners now so they can run dogs through scanners to find out?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, I believe that is correct.
Okay, on a different issue. Page 1, sub C of Big B, down about half of the page, a dog in a vehicle is securely confined in a manner that prevents the dog from biting a person other than intruder to the vehicle. So if the dog is in the back of a pickup and someone walks by and the dog bites them, then they would say that's not securely confined. This means basically the dog has to be enclosed inside of a pickup. Is that the intention here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, my reading of that, and when going back and forth in this language, it wasn't to require that the dog be in a kennel inside, but simply be that it be secured by a tether or a chain or whatever, so that the dog can't reach, like in a parking lot situation, you know, you're in a Fred Meyer parking lot, the dog reaches over and bites somebody. I mean, the idea is to encourage dogs to be, that not be a means of intimidation or frightening people in a parking lot. And again, that applies only to the dog running at large situation and not to the dog bite itself. This would be just if somebody was going to charge somebody with dog at large, because the definition of dog at large is that not in the company of an, under the control of its keeper. Well, if the keeper's in the store, you know, is somebody getting in a ticket for dog at large because the dog's in a tethered pickup? The dog's confined, the answer is no. Tethered, the answer is no.
Ms. Follett.
Representative Barr.
So if that's the case, reverse is true, that if a dog is sitting in the back of a pickup not tied, conceivably someone can come along and give that owner of that dog or the keeper of that dog now a ticket for dog at large?
Yes, conceivably. I think people have a lot better things to do than that. Police officers wasting their time doing that.
Mr. Chair, one more.
Certainly, Barr.
I made a comment. I think that section just put a mandatory seatbelt law for dogs in the state, and I certainly can't support that.
I think as we had testimony that there is a fine line of interpreting dogs run at large. We had this other attorney that was here and testified that apparently if a dog is in the back of a pickup, he technically is not under control of the owner, and he is running at large. And there is interpretation of that out there by some people. But I think really what we're talking about here is, I like this because I have walked by pickups with dogs, and those things jump out at you. They scare you to death. You don't realize that they're that aggressive. You just get that close to a vehicle. And I think that a dog that would... is allowed to threaten a person or come that close or could bite you when you walk by. I'd say they're not under control.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, if I might add, I think under current law, whether the dog is tethered or not, it could be considered to be running at large
because the owner or the keeper isn't there. The keeper's inside the store. And so if anything, this affords more protection to a dog owner in that situation that they could not receive a ticket. I mean, I've never seen one, but if anything, it provides more protection from getting a ticket to a responsible owner than exists under the current law. Because clearly, if the keeper isn't around, the dog's not under their control.
Representative Thompson, we're going to need to be moving
Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments.
That's great.
And either, would you like to do the conceptual amendment to add the one?
Which?
I don't know whether...
Then I'd just like to move the Dash 1 amendment.
Is that important that we muddle this
2425.
Up word or not?
Okay, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 2425.
Clarification. Representative Hill,
that is the LC-1 amendment, unamended.
Dash one. We have dash one.
Okay.
Any discussion on the motion?
I don't support it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Decker.
If Representative Thompson or others, I like Representative Crummell's addition of the one. I'm supportive of either, but would prefer, if possible, that one is in there. I think it makes it a better section.
What was that? I was confused.
It was on page 4, at the bottom of the page. It's subsection 2. It says, Dog Control Board, county governing body, or court has discretion in making the decisions described in subsection 1. And this section is not required to treat any one factor listed in that subsection as control as a factor. And I agree that it does clarify it.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Hill?
I will not be able to support Dash 1 amendments.
Okay.
I could withdraw my motion, and we could.
What
are the conceptual amendments?
Yeah, we can conceptually put that amendment in. Representative Hill, what is your problem with the amendment?
Microchips.
The microchipping. Representative Beyer, what is your problem with the amendments?
I think I could probably have to go through and pick out about half a dozen. I mean, the microchip is one. That section on being tethered, that dog has to be confined in the back of a pickup. Without having gone through it more completely, I know there's many other subtle changes in here that I haven't figured out yet.
Can I make a comment?
Representative Thompson.
This happens a lot, so as long as we have the majority of the votes.
I'm not saying don't move it. I'm just saying I'm a no.
I'm going to make a comment.
Representative Oberlin.
You know, as long as we are making proposed changes to a law, which we do a lot, I think it behooves ourselves to look at the laws as this now, and when there are obvious irrational provisions, we should also clean up the laws that exist. We're not doing that. That wouldn't keep me from voting for this one way or another, but I think that's something, if you don't have law that people respect and understand, I mean, we are a country of laws, and we need to have that to our population respect. And some of this stuff here, like being a public nuisance because you scatter garbage, well, maybe some of the responsibility is on the person to have their garbage can top on securely so the dog can't scatter it. So I just want to make that comment that we add things to laws and at the same time don't clean up some of the garbage that's already in them, no pun intended. But and I also have some problem with the microchip. It's like Star Wars or something. These are animals. These are free. I don't even have a dog, but somehow putting a microchip in a dog.
I think what we'll do is adjourn the work session on this. We can bring this bill back we have still have time, and I'll give you an opportunity to visit with the members.
Great, thank you.
We have a motion.
Yes, I have a motion
to withdraw.
We take a motion to adjourn over to go over top.
Right, it was over my motion.
Oh, okay. It was?
Yes.
They can still pass.
We're still in work session. House Bill 542.
I know there is, I think there's many other subtle changes in here that I haven't figured out yet.
Can I make a comment?
Representative Thompson.
This happens a lot, so as long as we have the majority of the votes.
I'm not saying don't move it, I'm just saying I'm a no.
I'm going to make a comment.
Representative Oberlin.
You know, as long as we are making proposed changes to a law, which we do a lot, I think it behooves ourselves to look at the laws that exist now, and when there are obvious irrational provisions, we should also clean up the laws that exist. We're not doing that. That wouldn't keep me from voting for this one way or another, but I think that's something, if you don't have law that people respect and understand, I mean, we are a country of laws, and we need to have that. Our population respect it. And some of the stuff here, like being a public nuisance because you scatter garbage, well, maybe some of the responsibility is on the person to have their garbage can top on securely so the dog can't scatter. So I just want to make that comment that we add things to laws and at the same time don't clean up some of the garbage that's already in them, no pun intended. But and I also have some problem with the microchip. It's like Star Wars or something. These are animals. These are free animals. I don't even have a dog, but somehow putting a microchip in a dog.
I think what we'll do is adjourn the work session on this. We can bring this bill back. We have still have time, and I'll give you an opportunity to visit with the members.
Great, thank you.
We have a motion.
Yes, I have a motion
to withdraw.
We'll take a motion to adjourn over to go over top.
Right, it was over my motion.
Oh, okay. It was?
Yes.
They can still pass.
We're still in work session. House Bill 5425.
I'd still like to keep my motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. If you would like to go to this, I guess we can do the motion to conceptually amend the one into it, since we have that motion in front of us. So I would like to suspend the rules and allow the conceptual amendment to add the word one.
So that's your motion?
That's my motion.
We have a motion in front of us to adopt the Dash 1s conceptually amended by the word one. Samantha, would you like to call the roll, please?
Farewell.
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Isla?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
No.
Representative Mill?
No.
Representative Pepper?
Yes.
Representative Hoffman?
Yes.
Representative
Crummel?
Aye. Excuse me, point of clarification. Didn't we just vote on adding the word one only? I mean, that's all we voted on right now.
Dash ones with the one.
Oh, then I would like to change my vote to no.
Well, weren't we supposed to? We had to have unanimous. Okay, we have to have unanimous agreement
to suspend the rules.
To suspend the rules for the conceptual amendment. We didn't do that.
No.
Then we have to allow the conceptual agreement. Then we have to go to the amendment.
Right.
And we didn't go through the proper procedure.
Right. And that's why I was confused.
Right. But the procedure that you're proposing, you're leaving me, it's clear to me that we could go ahead and vote on your motion and then amend conceptually into the bill.
Okay.
That would be a smoother, neater process if you don't want to withdraw your motion.
So we have still We had a motion, and that motion...
The motion that was on the floor before we thought about adjourning was move the dash one into the bill as it is. That's a motion that we could consider. It sounds like we should consider that and then talk about adding the word one.
Okay. Let's try that again.
Let's try the vote again.
Okay, let's try the vote again.
Let's try it again. We have the motion to move the dash one, Samantha. As they're currently written.
I have to write down what you guys are doing.
I don't know how you could.
Mr. Chair, before you call for that vote, asking Representative Hill, since he's kind of our resident parliamentarian.
He's given
up. As far as the procedure that we're going through would be my question, Representative.
I guess I would suggest that I don't think members had any problems about suspending the rules to conceptually amend, so it sort of goes without saying that that was implicit in going forward. You know, if the vote is 4-5, then 4-5. Chair can rule it is done.
I call the roll again, Samantha.
Before we do, what are we voting on now?
Dash one.
Without the word one.
Without the word one.
Okay.
Chair Wells?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Udula?
No.
Representative Fire?
No.
Representative Hill?
No.
Representative Decker?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Crump?
No.
Representative Crummel?
Aye.
Four.
And that just puts the amendments in.
That puts the amendments into the bill as written.
Motion carried.
It's conceptual.
Now I'm going to adjourn the work session, and we're going to work this bill a little more. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3429. This is a little bill that started out fairly simple. As we got into it, we found that it wasn't quite so simple. Pat, you like to come on up?
I'd like free air for
them. Yes. This bill was here at the request of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I don't know how many of you were visited by Pat ahead of time, but I don't know if you had as hard a time understanding exactly what this bill did as I did, but Pat has been out working with quite a few of the parties on this issue, and I hope we're fairly close to coming to an agreement on this so we can get through kind of our agenda without spending an hour on this issue.
Exactly. My hope's exactly.
Yeah, Harrison, give us a quick overview from your perspective of what's been going on with this issue.
Well, this bill allows multiple winery licensees to exercise privileges of a winery license at a single location. That is, allows for multiple licenses to be issued for a single processing facility. I think at that, I'm going to stop and let Pat tell you more about this issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Pat Egan. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, and with me is Eric Homaker of Homaker Wines. Before I begin, I'd just like to note on the second page of the bill, in line 8, use the word single location. I'll not be asking for a conceptual amendment to change that to one. That's okay with the committee?
thank you. Fine.
There you go.
Lost his vote.
I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'll assure you, Pat, I'm not going to recognize Representative Crummel at all.
That's good. Well, thank you for having me here this morning. Hopefully I will be able to make it a little more simple than our initial conversation here. Basically, the bill would allow OLCC to change its procedure. Right now, their procedure is to not allow more than one winery license per premise, and they're here in the room with us today, so if I say anything wrong, they'll be quick to correct me. Right now, wine growers are allowed to produce wine at a winery under a grower sales privilege license, and there are other machinations small winemakers have to go through in order to get their products to market. But basically, what we're looking for is to allow one of the largest, one of the fastest growing agricultural businesses in the state, and the young entrepreneurs who make wine to have the ability to be licensed as a winery, which is, as we see it, the appropriate license for them to conduct their business. And I think OLCC agrees. You've got my written testimony, and I'm going to keep it very short. I think Eric's got a good statement of his experience in the state of California, which does allow multiple winery licenses at a single premise, and he's got some experience on both ends of that, both multiple licenses at one location and a single entity with several sub-wineries that is taxed as a single winery. So with that, I'm going to just lead into Eric and let him give his testimony, if that's all right.
Thanks, Pat. As Pat said, my name is Eric Homaker. By education and professional experience, I'm a winemaker. Here before the committee today to offer testimony in support of House Bill 3429. I'll keep my comments brief as it's a pretty straightforward bill and has no opposition. In roughly 30 years, Oregon has appeared on the wine scene internationally and has established a reputation mainly through production of small lots of wine by extremely small wineries. I first got the chance to work in Oregon over a decade ago and got to see the potential that was here. Everything after that six-month period of work up here was basically focused for me to come back, settle here, and try and open up my own winery. I returned in 1995. I'm still working on establishing my own winery. This bill would allow that to happen. Prior to returning to Oregon, I was winemaker at Etude Winery in the Napa Valley. This is a pretty interesting facility in that it was basically there were six independently operated and bonded wineries operating at one single shared facility. Basically, none of these wineries were big enough to support the the capital load required for the equipment or even just the facility itself. But by banding together and spreading that capital load over the six wineries, each one of these wineries was able to get up and get going. Two have gone on to found completely independent wineries. Two more of those are in the process of doing that right now. This type of cooperative arrangement has been commonplace in California for over a decade and has been recognized by the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms for longer than that. When I arrived in Oregon, I believed I would be able to set up this type of operation here. Unfortunately, that's not been able to happen thus far. Current Oregon law doesn't allow for any provision of multiple license holders in one facility, and many people wishing to start small wineries, myself included, have become wine wholesalers, buying wine, then selling it, as opposed to being wineries. I actually consult on grape growing to a number of growers. I buy the grapes that I consult on, I sell those grapes, and then buy the wine back from a winery that produces wine from those grapes. On top of the obvious loss of production control, there are increased costs and ultimately decreased returns as I'm unable to cultivate any appreciable amount of direct mail or direct sales business. Wine is sold in restaurants, wine shops, and to out-of-state distributors, sometimes at a loss of up to 50% of the potential value of that wine being sold directly to end users. Furthermore, as a wholesaler, I'm unable to participate in direct sales events or consumer events like the International Pinot Noir Celebration in McMinnville, the biggest Pinot Noir event of its type in the world. Ironically, these barriers exist for me and those like me in Oregon, but not for like entities in California that operate with the full privilege of being a bonded winery. Even here in Oregon, they're able to operate with all the privileges of a winery license. Privileges like direct sale of wine in any quantity as opposed to a 5-gallon minimum sale. Participate in winery or wine tastings. Participate in Oregon developed promotions like the IPNC. Without this bill, the Oregon industry is becoming more and more prohibitive to small wineries, the very entities that founded and have fired the growth of the wine industry in Oregon and produce the wines that attract the larger entities with more capital and that develop here and set up in Oregon. I urge you to support House Bill 3429 and to streamline winery licensing and the growth of an industry that has brought a lot of attention and praise on Oregon agriculture. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. It's nice to have you here today.
Thank you, Jim.
Currently, what type of a license do you have?
I'm a wholesaler.
Is yours called a wholesaler?
Wholesale malt wine beverage.
When Pat came and visited with me about this bill, we were discussing what type of license those people currently have. It says here in our staff measure, Harrison called it a grower sales permit. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, and let me clarify if I can. There are a number of ways that smaller winemakers can try to get their products to market. One of those ways is not necessarily having a winery license. That's what we're trying to allow for them right now. Under the grower sales privilege license, a person or an individual, an entity that grows grapes may bring those to a winery facility and produce wine out of that, and then have control individually over the production and the sale of the wine. For others that do not necessarily have their own property, they have to go through, in order to maintain compliance, they have to go through, like Mr. Homaker does, a great deal of machinations in order to stay in compliance. Basically, here are my grapes. This is what I'd like to see potentially, I think, when you're done, but I don't have control over the production as it's going through the process. It's repurchased and then is sold as a wholesaler. And in that case, Mr. Homaker's case, he's basically limited to sales of 5 gallons or more, in which obviously is not able to make direct individual sales.
Did you get into, just a minute here, obviously, did you get into the issue with OLCC on the privilege tax and that sort of issue? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Because I couldn't, and I'd actually...
Maybe they would like to come up.
Invite them up. And that's something that I know Harrison has some language. We may be okay with it. Our intention with the bill is to allow small winemakers to be licensed in the appropriate way, which is to have a winery license. When we initially ran the language past OLCC, their revenue folks who are here told us that they would anticipate taxing wineries in that way, in the same way that they tax wineries in the state of California. To make it express is absolutely fine with us in the bill. If you could go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Walsh. I'm here to represent the commission. And I'm sorry, what exactly is the question?
Yeah, the issue came up concerning we have a privilege tax of wineries that produce less than 100,000 gallons. We'll pay the tax only on the first 40,000 gallons of wine produced. And I guess the issue was whether potentially a large winery, by obtaining more winery licenses at that location, could separate their production enough that then they could fall into a different tax category.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that was probably the only concern, and it was probably a mild one at that, but that the commission had, is that a winery could do exactly that. And I think this is what prompted the amendments. And
right.
I think this
we have some Dash 1 amendments that Harrison's kind of tried to draw up. I don't know where those are.
Mr. Chair, members, we do have a Dash 1 amendment from LC. We can pass that out if you'd like, but I think that Pat and I are in agreement that that language obviously is not as good as the language that he and I had worked on.
Yeah,
basically, just to get to the point of it, there is an exemption, and as you said, it is possible that a large winery could try to subdivide into a number of different entities to take full advantage of the exemption for each one of those entities. When we initially talked with OLCC, it's not our intention with the bill, and we're comfortable with making it express that if it's the same group or individuals that are in control of the different entities, as they do in California, they tax them all in the aggregate as one entity, so that there's no evasion, basically, just by way of creating a new.
I would think as long as there was the same names on those licenses or whatever, that they couldn't really separate it out.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess on that question, in terms of would there ever be a reason why someone would want to have ownership in multiple wineries, in terms of where someone may be the majority owner? They may own one over here and one over there. Does that happen today in terms of?
I'm just curious
in terms of if we do that, does that have another effect on the marketplace and your ability to attract capital, or somebody may say, yeah, I'll invest the capital, but I want to own 51% of it, you know, but they also own another winery over here where they ultimately have controlling interest, but they may not be operating. And how do we distinguish between that so that we don't create a disincentive for capital and to accomplish what you're talking about? I don't understand enough about the winery business to understand whether that's going to be an issue or not. That would be my only concern in terms of is sort of the evasion through multiple licenses. But otherwise, it looks to me like a good bill for economic development and encouraging horticulture.
President Barr.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if anyone thought about our governor with his treatment of privilege taxes. Obviously, he would veto any opportunity there would be if it was chance to change tax programs here.
Mr. Chair, perhaps we could double tax them and then it would be okay.
Yeah, that might work. Getting back to our main issue here, where are we on this issue of these amendments, or do we need an amendment to your bill? Is that what we're saying?
Well, I think potentially we would be happy to make it express if that's what the committee would like to do. We had submitted language to legislative council that OLCC had checked off on that basically said this will reflect the way that we anticipate taxing these entities. It was slightly changed in legislative council, and the person who is certified smart on that is not here with me today, but I think we can come up with language in Hendricks.
Do we really need to change the bill the way it's currently written?
Well, that's really up to you, I think, and OLCC's comfort level.
Mr. Chair, members, I really sort of initiated, expressed the concern on behalf of OLCC, and so I think if OLCC does not feel like we need it, I certainly am not looking to burden Mr. Egan's bill with my concerns.
Representative Oberlin.
I think this is a very good bill. There's a potential. There's always a potential out there for people to misuse any bill, and I suppose you could divide up an existing place to make a smaller entity so that you wouldn't be taxed. So I think what we have to decide, do we want to do preventative medicine, so to speak, or let it go forward as it is and see if there's any abuse in the future? So that's really what we need to address.
Mr. Chair, I'm just largely in agreement and would ask OLCC to just be vigilant of the issue and let us know if it does arise, and I think that would be the best manner to proceed.
Representative Thompson?
I'd like to move House Bill 3429 before do pass recommendation.
I mean, if there's problems, let's amend it on the Senate side.
Can we move bill in hearing?
That'll work.
We're not in work session. Sorry.
Work session.
Sorry.
Okay. Let's get in one and move it.
We're in work session on House Bill 3429. This committee gets ahead of the chair. You're happy with the bill? You're fine?
Yes.
Well, now we need a motion.
I'd like a motion to move House Bill 3429 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion of the motion? Samantha, call the roll, please. Or somebody wants to amend it.
The one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Zion?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Becker?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes. Yes.
Motion passed, and where does Bill come from?
Right.
Judiciary Civil Law. Anyone interested in carrying this bill?
I think Hill wants to.
Excellent, Karen.
I'll carry it.
Okay, great. Thank you all very much.
Sure. Thank you
very much.
Thank you,
Eric, for coming.
Who do we have here?
2373. Here. Fish and Wildlife's here.
And I think Representative Byer has at 10 o'clock.
Representative Byer's amendment.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2373. This is Representative Byer's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roger Byer, State Representative, District 28. With me is Wayne Van Dyke, a friend of mine from Mount Angel, and Joe Rollator is here somewhere. He thought he was following us up here. House Bill 2373, as introduced, would require a valid shellfish tag to be on the possession while you are harvesting shellfish, which includes clams and crabs. I've been in discussion with the bill with different members of the House and with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I would like to, I don't have them drafted at this time, but we have amendments coming on the bill that would change the bill from its current form to requiring a fishing license to be acquired before you could harvest clams on the coast. So it would not affect the crabbing at all, but it would say that if you want to harvest clams, you'd have to have a valid fishing license. As I said, I don't have the amendments yet, but we do have them in the process, and hopefully they'll be in front of us soon. So with that, I'd like to introduce Wayne Van Dyke. He's the one that brought this issue to me during the interim, and we discussed it, and we were submitted the request for this. So I'd like to let him speak to the bill first, and then I have to answer any questions you may have.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome, Wayne. You were here before on another one of those bills that he had, weren't you? Was that you that was here before?
Yes, Chairman Wells, a member of the committee. Yes, I was here wanting to make it necessary that a person be in Oregon for 15 years before you could get an overage 70 free hunting or fishing license.
I don't think that issue is dead yet. I think we're kind of holding it back as we look at the whole fishing licenses and hunting licenses as far as the fee structure, and so we're kind of holding that bill back.
I would hope that the bill that originally put together was prompted by a trip up to our neighbors to the north where my 5-year-old grandson had to have licenses to crab and anything else, and then I come to find that, as the representative from Clatsop County said, the people in Washington come down here and they're just sucking the clams out of our beaches, and they don't pay any license, and yet we go up there, they catch us, and we got a license to do anything up there. So I also noticed that as crabbing is being dropped out of this, and I haven't seen the final, as Roger doesn't have it completed, but we're giving away a lot of things in the state of Oregon. I don't need to, and that's triggered this whole thing. First, I guess what's juice for the goose is juice for the gander. They're going to license charge me up there. We should charge down here. I originally provided a stamp such as a bird stamp or such, basically because I didn't want to say I'm going to tax you, the big clams, but I've got a license, so I don't have to buy another license. I have no problem with a angling license being mandatory to big clams. I'm happy with that. I think it's been a long time coming. I think it's necessary. I think that it will provide funds to pay for the law enforcement of our crabbing or our clamming, which now is being diverted from other fish and wildlife monies. I understand there are research monies needed for, I want to call it the red tide, but that's not quite the right term. It's a disease of the clams, and we don't know what's causing it or how or if we can control it. But here is a place where many people who don't have a fishing license would have to come to the table and work with us together.
Yeah, thank you. That's good testimony.
Mr. Chair, are we in a work session, or are we?
No, it's just a hearing right now.
Okay.
Roger, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you, why was crabbing deleted? Why are we limiting it to only clamming now, if I'm understanding the dash ones correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, many negotiations with members of the Coastal Caucus and others trying to get some legs on this clam.
That a person be in Oregon for 15 years before you can get an overage 70 free hunting or fishing license.
I don't think that issue is dead yet. I think we're kind of holding it back to, as we look at the whole fishing licenses and hunting licenses as far as the fee structure, and so we're kind of holding that bill back.
I would hope that the bill that originally put together was prompted by a trip. Our neighbors to the north, where my five-year-old grandson had to have licenses to crab and anything else, and then I come to find that, as the representative from Clatsop County said, the people in Washington come down here and they're just sucking the clams out of our beaches, and they don't pay any license, and yet we go up there, they catch us, and we got a license to do anything up there. So I also noticed that as crabbing is being dropped out of this, and I haven't seen the final, as Roger doesn't have it completed, but we're giving away a lot of things in the state of Oregon. I don't need, and that's triggered this whole thing. First, I guess what's juice for the goose is juice for the gander. They're going to license charge me up there. We should charge down here. I originally provided a stamp, such as a bird stamp or such. Basically because I didn't want to say I'm going to tax you the big clams, but I got a license, so I don't have to buy another license. I have no problem with a angling license being mandatory to big clams. I mean, I'm happy with that. I think it's been a long time coming. I think it's necessary. I think that it will provide funds to pay for the law enforcement of our crabbing or our clamming, which now is being diverted from other fish and wildlife monies. I understand there are research monies needed for, I want to call it the red tide, but that's not quite the right term. It's a disease of the clams, and we don't know what's causing it or how or if we can control it. But here is a place where many people who don't have a fishing license would have to come to the table and work with us together.
Yeah, thank you. That's good testimony.
Mr. Chair, are we in a work session, or are we?
No, it's just a hearing right now.
Okay.
Roger,
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you, why was crabbing deleted? Why are we limiting it to only clamming now, if I'm understanding the dash ones correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, many negotiations with members of the Coastal Caucus and others trying to get some legs on this clam. I decided that in order to make this bill fly, that we had to maybe narrow the focus a little bit. But I think the main reason is this, that for the crab fishing there really isn't any research necessary because the crab is a healthy population. I mean, it seems like, you know, they're just there by the billions. I mean, they're just always there. Where clams, on the other hand, the last few years is in particular, about this time of year when people are really getting geared to go clamming, their toxin shows up in the clams and they have to close the clam season. And the Fish and Wildlife Department, I think, would like to be able to have some money to study to find out if they can find out why that is. And this is an opportunity for them to maybe generate some funds and target them toward that program so that we can maybe do some research in that area.
Representative Thompson, have you been a part of this discussion?
For years. Part of the reason that crabbing is on the coast, we have a situation where because of the restriction of salmon, we have a lot of small marinas that literally were potentially be wiped out because of the closure of salmon. The only thing they have going for them now is the sport crab fishery, especially during the winter months. And if you were to curtail that, we would lose a lot of those marinas. We still have hope someday to be able to fish. Where clam isn't the same situation, and I've recognized the problem they've addressed for years and on the Washington coast, back and forth. And I happen to be a Democrat who believes that the state doesn't have to derive money from everything, but in negotiation, I came to some reconciliation with my attitude.
So where are we now, Representative Byer? We're bringing this back for another hearing when you get your amendments drawn up, or we don't have these amendments now, do we?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you're correct. We do not have the amendments yet from LC. We should get them shortly, I would assume, and I would ask to be scheduled for a hearing at that, or a work session. That.
So then we can have further testimony from the department, everybody, when you get the amendments here, or do we want to have more testimony today? Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment in terms of, you know, whatever the negotiations are. It's one area of concern is the relating clause in the bill is relating to shellfish tags, and Legislative Council has put in three sections of wild cell angling, which has to do with possession of fishing, salmon, and steelhead, and I don't know what the effect of that is, but it doesn't seem to be related to the relating clause, which would put the bill in jeopardy as being unconstitutional. Single subject, so you might ask them why they added those three words in three places because it doesn't seem to fit within the shellfish tag relating clause.
Where are you referring to?
Right? Lines 11, 16, and 22.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I believe that that's just language which changes the grammatical structure to allow this new clause. I think that's the case.
It seems to be relating to the possession of it while you're angling, which seems to be substantive, versus you can have a tag. I mean, it could be wrong. It just seemed to be out of place under the relating clause and have nothing to do with the shellfish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, for pointing that out. Yeah. That may be a concern.
Right. You're talking about line 11, valid salmon steelhead tag while sole angling.
Right. If it just seems to be substantive rather than just changing the grammatical.
Well, it would seem like if we're going to have an amendment that's going to basically gut and stuff this thing, then there wouldn't be a problem with it.
If they keep that same language, I don't know what it means in relationship to fishing, and since the relating clause has to do with shellfish tags, that doesn't seem to be.
You're talking about a fishing license.
What are you doing?
Yeah, I understand Representative Hill's concerns, and I will discuss that with them and make sure that we can make it work. Otherwise, we'll figure out another way to do it.
Okay. Well, if this bill doesn't work, maybe you can find another bill. I guess with that, then,
thank you very much,
we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2373 and see what he comes up with. As he said, he's trying to find legs under his issue here. And
Clam legs.
They only have one.
May I ask Representative Thompson a question about this?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Is the bill as it presently exists, as you This is your bill, isn't it?
No.
No. I would never get that.
Buyer's bill.
Okay, so
that's
this is not a...
an increasing a fee, and I'm a Democrat who doesn't believe in...
Hey, we like the sound of that.
But the bill would not fly in your community, period, as is, separate from the other issues.
I think there'll be a lot less resistance if it's, since so many people there are already involved in sport fishing and they already possess them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to meet with...
Well, her question was the current bill was not a bill you would have
seen. I'm not talking about his CJ. I'm talking about the current bill that exists.
No.
That would not fly.
No,
not at all. Yeah, this issue has been around quite a while, and it's never had to...
Never been able to pass it.
Never has.
Thank you, Representative Thompson, for...
Yeah.
It's Representative Byers' ability to think out of the box or the shell.
I wish you'd think about a few more issues.
We're going to stand at ease just for a minute. John McCulley will be back. He said a quarter till. Here, after standing at ease for a minute, House Ag and Forestry, we're going to open the hearing now on House Bill 3297. This is a bill brought to us at the request of Representative Montgomery. He's not going to be here to testify, but it's on on behalf of Hood River Growers and Shippers Association, and John McCulley is here. He represents that group, and Harrison, what is your understanding of this bill?
There is an existing farm worker housing tax credit. The tax credit has been in effect since 1989, with some changes. There's been sunset provisions renewed periodically, and some other changes have been made. What this bill would do is set aside 10% of the annual limitation on eligible costs for employer-owned small housing projects. It also modifies the tax credit application procedure and establishes some standards for considering applications when the applications would entail a larger credit than is available under the annual limit. It would give the Department of Consumer and Business Services standards for determining which applications should be approved. And I will stop there.
I don't know whether I understand exactly all that you said. Representative Hill?
Questions, Mr. Chair. Does this bill have a subsequent down to revenue?
It does have a subsequent to revenue, and I thank you for putting that on the record for everyone to help me remember that if we move the bill.
Representative Oberlin.
Yes, maybe John can answer this. Actually, I only have one question. Why did you lower the amount from 3.3 to 2.75, I think that's what I read. And that was rather curious to me.
Where are we talking about here?
We're talking about the credit approval.
Mr. Chair, Representative Warbelow, there is a $3.3 million annual limit on the credit, and this bill sets aside 10% of it for employer projects. The remainder is $2.97 million for unrestricted projects. Which, by the way, the bill does now distinguish between unrestricted projects and employer-owned small projects.
Well, to get into this a little bit further so we understand what kind of tax credits we're talking about here and all this sort of thing, I think I'll turn this over to John, and maybe you can explain to us, what are we talking about here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John McCulley representing the tree fruit growers. First of all, I want to apologize for not being in the room when you were ready for this, and I appreciate your courtesy and waiting for me. This bill, I'll just try to briefly give you some history about how we got to where we are, why the level is set as it is, and why this bill is before you. As you heard, the tax credit was first initiated in 1989. It had a six-year sunset, so in the 1995 session, the tax credit came up for renewal and was renewed at that time. Representative Schoon, chair of the Revenue Committee, had some concerns about how this credit was being used, and asked that a lid be put on the amount of credit that was available. His concern was primarily that large projects in communities were not solely being used by farm workers, that they may be used for farm workers for a while, but those farm workers would eventually get jobs elsewhere, but still continue to live in the housing where the tax credit was allowed. So he wanted to limit the amount of a credit that was available. It was a 50% tax credit. That was lowered to 30%. So it's 30% credit over a five-year period. The credit is for construction costs used to establish new housing or renovate existing housing. And so we are working at this point with a $3.3 million cap for the housing that is provided or used each year. The bill went through a rulemaking process in OSHA, and part of that process, we sought to have a certain amount of money set aside for grower-owned projects. Our concern was that a large project, and Woodburn or Cornelius or wherever it might be, could come in and use up the entire $3.3 million, and none would be available for small projects that growers provide. The grower projects tend to be $40,000 to $50,000 from the data that we've had to look at. So we wanted to make sure that there was a set-aside there. CASA of Oregon and the tree fruit industry that Tom Nelson represents here agreed that the set-aside was probably an okay thing to do, or OSHA did that. It came to the Legislative Council Committee for review, and they saw that it did not meet the plain language of the statute, that the plain language did not allow a set-aside to occur. And as a result of that, the bill is before you, because we anticipated in all of the work we did in the 95 session to get this passed that it was clear in our minds that the intent of the legislature was to make sure that growers could have access to this tax credit to renovate or put in new housing. So the bill is before you that takes that $3.3 million available tax credit and sets aside 10% of it for on-farm grower-provided housing. So the total amount of the credit is still the same. It just allocates a certain part of that to growers.
So, John, that's the $330,000 that's in line 40 here.
That's correct, Mr.
10%. Now, again, if I'm a farmer out there and I want to build a building for farm workers, what kind of a credit do I get on that if I spend $50,000 under current law?
Mr. Chair, you can get a credit of up to $15,000 taken over a five-year period.
30% of the... Okay.
Right.
I know some growers have done that, but I never did know exactly how that worked. Okay, we have some questions. Let's start down that end. Representative Cromwell, way down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of different questions. John, what kind of a tax credit is it? Property tax, income tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, it's a credit against income tax.
Okay, and so this is a self-funding program then?
Mr. Chair, no. It is a reduction of revenue that comes into the state as a result of this program. I might add, Mr. Chair, this process that the House Revenue Committee has just gone through, reviewing all tax credits.
All the exemptions.
Exemptions and credits, yes, the list.
Yes.
This one did not make the list because it was felt by the Revenue Committee to be such a valuable program. So it was just passed over and said we should continue that credit, just as a point of information there.
Thank you. And one last question, Mr. Chair. Does it create a tax shift then? Or is it just a plain reduction in revenues, and so those just aren't revenues that we see?
Mr.
We don't
Chair.
Go out and try to collect from somebody else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, this is $3.3 million less that comes into the state of Oregon that's available in your general revenues.
Thank you.
Representative Irwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And John, we've added that language on page 4 that about employer-owned small projects. I am assuming, but I would like to know for the record, these employer-owned small projects on their property do have to meet the requirements that they comply with all occupational safety, health laws, rules, regulations. In other words, the standard that's already in the law for the large projects, but the small projects would have to meet that also. Is that correct?
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Huberlau, these projects actually have different standards because these are considered workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why OSHA does inspect them, and they are required to meet the occupancy standards of OSHA. Other projects, and there are people here who work on the community projects, are meeting general housing standards, I believe, and they can clarify that. But yes, these grower-provided projects do have to meet the standards and are subject to inspection by OSHA. And they have to meet that occupancy standard before they can be occupied, can be certified.
We have, along that line, we have a bill in this committee, which I did not have a hearing on, was introduced by Representative Bowman, that would have mandated that all these workplace housing projects that are inspected by Department of Business and Consumer Services, which is Oregon or OSHA, inspected at least every 2 years. And then I was provided with some materials showing currently there's about 300 in the state. The last year they inspected about 150. So they are inspecting about, on that basis, every 2 years, all of them. And this would be the type of housing we're talking about, grower-provided or housing for farm workers.
Well, I think, thank you, Mr. I think where the question arises, and I can't remember if it was the Oregonian or the Statesman Journal had a series of articles, was it the Oregonian, about the substandard housing. And yet I see in the existing law right now about the credit, it says that the housing has to comply with all occupational safety or health laws. So maybe the real issue is not having enough people to inspect. It's not that they're not required to meet.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Huberlau, that is probably a little bit different than what we're talking about in this bill, but we do support an aggressive inspection and enforcement program,
right?
Because I think most of the growers, at least that we represent, are doing a good job, but clearly there are some improvements that need to be made by some people.
I have one final question, and then actually I need to leave, but if I could, Mr. Chair, is this program has been around for some time. Has it been used up to the limit on a consistent basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huberlau, on the back of my testimony, I have copied the latest figures that we have on the program for at least the last 3 years, and you can see what the amount has been and what percent of that has been used by growers. We understand that there may be some other credits that would be applied to 98, but to come up to the 3.3 million.
They didn't use it all.
Yeah. And there are some talk of trying to raise the amount of credit just because it is such a critical program and critical state policy.
We have floor session at 10:15, so we don't have a lot of time. Would your guest like to introduce himself? And we have a couple other people signed up that to testify, and they've marked that they are opposed to this bill, so we need to hear from them.
Yes, my name is Tom Nelson. I'm the executive director of the Hood River Grower Shipper Association. About 40% of the farm worker housing units in the state are in our area. If you add in the Dalles, it gets a little higher, which is next door to us. From 1989 till 1995, when the tax credit program was in place, there were nobody tracked it. It was interesting. You just went to your accountant, showed him a bunch of receipts and a letter from OSHA that said your housing is in spec, and you'd get the 50% tax credit. And so at 1995, it was interesting. Somebody said, well, how much has been done? So some calls were made, and the legislature asked, well, you know, what are we doing here? Calls were made, and there's no tracking. So that's why we only have statistics starting in 1996. Otherwise, it was just kind of wide open. Everybody could take the tax credit if you applied. Also, I just want to comment that we do have to also meet the county building code standards. So, I mean, these are inspected through the building process. Then when they're completed, OROSHA has to come out and do an OROSHA inspection, which has actually some different rules even than what's in your home to make sure it's up to snuff, and then the tax credit can be issued.
You'd have to have a permit also.
Yes.
Permitting process.
Yes.
From the...
Yes. Land use issues have to be done, so it's, none of this is done without great oversight.
I think with that, John, we need to bring up...
I'd just like one comment, that the reason why we urge the set-aside is that we're really dealing with apples and oranges. The large community base, which is what uses the rest of the money, tend to have a year or two, you know, startup time while they plan, find the land, find, you know, their million-dollar projects while they, you know, find the need. Whereas the projects we're talking about tend to be done by the growers. And anybody in agriculture knows you have an interesting calendar of when your money comes up, depending on your crop. You don't necessarily have just one point in time of the year when you could compete with the other housing units. And in fact, in 1998, the last year, when money was still available because one of the projects was not completed by the community base, throughout the whole year, people came in and used the tax credits, and it was the most efficient and most effective. So from the grower side, throughout the year, they make business decisions to do this.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, can you just be blunt here? I mean, I'm getting this picture of, you know, wonderful housing stock. This is, everyone that I've seen of these, they're not pretty. Are not necessarily what I would consider sanitary. And I'm just trying to get a sense in terms of, I mean, you're up in Hood River. In terms of, I've never been up there. I don't know in terms of what you're providing in terms of for your seasonal workers up there. But I'm knowing the ones that are down in my community, you know, I'd be surprised if they're getting tax credits. If they're getting tax credits, I wouldn't want them to get tax credits for it because... These are not nice places. And so,
Representative Hill, I need to take you out here right on off of Joseph, the exit here going out my district. There's a fellow that has a fruit operation there, and I visited his, and it's very nice. He has a kind of a multi-purpose building, but it's all blacktopped around it. And in the winter, then, he does store his fruit boxes in there, has big doors, but it's a beautiful facility. It has its own cooking thing, and it's all built on.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
So there are,
and I'm not familiar with that. I'm just familiar with what I've seen in my community, and they are not pretty.
Yeah.
And maybe they're not getting tax credits, which is probably a good thing. You know, I just question whether they're even the standard.
Mr. Chair, I know you're in a hurry, but I'll just briefly respond. One of the reasons, Representative Hill, that we have the tax credit program is to try to address the issues that exist in parts of the state. I mean, we understand that there are some horrendous facilities out there, and they may not even be licensed, which is a problem to start with. But the second issue is we want to provide, and I think the state policy is good, to say that for those who have substandard conditions, here's an incentive to increase and improve those facilities. So that's why we have the program. Thank you.
I'd like to bring up Peter Hanley and David Noble. David's from the Oregon Law Center. He appears in front of the Judiciary Committee quite a bit. I don't think you're used to being in front of the Ag Committee, are you, David?
I am not, Mr. Chair.
Be careful over here with us Aggies now. We're not a bunch of attorneys.
It is a pleasure to be here, and I will defer to Mr. Hanley.
Okay.
First.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm with Community and Shelter Assistance Corp, CASA of Oregon. We're based out of Newburgh, and we develop predominantly community-based farm worker housing. And we've developed units throughout the state, Talent, Irrigan, Mullowa, Hillsboro, all throughout the state. We're opposed to this tax credit less for the set-aside, we've pretty much had a standing gentleman's agreement, I think, with the growers' associations around the state to try and split this up. More so some of the language in the bill that it would, how it would affect the selection of projects if there's more than the $3.3 million submitted, leaving it up to OSHA to basically decide what is going to create the best incremental units. And you have to have understanding that OSHA guidelines for temporary housing on farm are less stringent than those guidelines for in-town housing that we are constructing. And so our housing is going to be more expensive, but it's going to provide a lot more services. It's going to be based in the communities. And that, I think, is key, is we want to see that the farm workers have the access to those services, medical, dental, et cetera. I think generally set-aside, I don't support set-aside requirements as a general rule. I think that there's other ways that we could work. In 1995, this tax credit was capped and the amount of eligible basis was reduced. And so that kind of created a little more competition for these funds. I wanted to make one correction. The actual impact of this is not $3.3 million. That's the eligible basis amount. It's $3.3 million times 30%, so it's about $1 million. And I think to get at Representative Hill's question, the orchardists have done a pretty good job throughout the state of housing their farm workers. Washington County has a completely different situation. They have less orchards, more crops such as strawberries, raspberries, et cetera, where the housing, the type of housing stock out there is a lot different. I think generally you'll see that orchardists do a much better job at housing than some of the other farmers groups. And there's a lot of limitations, not just money, but land use, et cetera, to providing some of this housing. I guess if there were to be some changes made to this legislation, I would look to Senate Bill 981, which is proposing two